Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you to this morning's regular meeting of the Board of the Metropolitan Transit System. And we'll start with the roll call, and I'll ask the clerk to please call the roll.
Alvarez. Mendoza. Bragg.
Here.
Cole.
Here.
Cunningham.
Here.
Gomez.
Here.
Mathis.
Here.
McClellan.
Here.
McWhorter. Minto.
Here.
Rios.
Here.
Roberts. Salas.
Here.
Sankey.
Here.
Zapp.
Okay, the first item of business is the approval of the minutes for January 19th. And unless there's a comment or a question, I'll take a motion to that effect. Mr. McWhorter, second by Mr. McClellan. No further discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? One abstention from Ms. Bragg. I don't have any speaker slips for public. Well, wait a minute. There is one that slipped in here. So we do have one public speaker, and I'll invite Ms. Gretchen Newsom to step up to the podium. You have 3 minutes, ma'am.
Thank you. Gretchen Newsom, representing IBEW 569, the local electricians union with over 3,400 members. I just wanted to report back to you. I have joined you for the last two meetings to request some updates and information pertaining to the installation of your solar bus shelters and in our perspective, how it was not being done properly by state certified electricians. We were successful in having a great follow-up meeting with your staff, and we have received some information that we will be following up on. So I look forward to future collaborations with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Newsom. Before we start our regular agenda, Paul and I have a presentation to make, and so we'll go to the podium.
This on? Yeah. Not so much a presentation as much as it is somewhat recognition. I wonder if Aaron Dunn and Gary Dexter and Jan Michael Reyes and Ivan Agostino would come up here. So these employees here, I just want to talk a little bit about them because they've really been part of something pretty extraordinary. This fall, with the Compass Card, you know, we have an online capability to reload your Compass Card. And it's called WebTix. And the WebTix is part of the Cubic system that we're all working on and getting toward a new version of it. But we started to see a huge influx of fraudulent activity. And now, you know, criminals can buy credit cards and the CVV numbers on the back and the zip codes and the addresses right on the internet fairly cheaply. And then, you know, we had an individual here, probably several, that are using those credit card numbers to buy monthly passes and then sell them at half rate to people on different websites. Anyway, so we got to the point late last year where we engaged Cubic and said, we've got this WebTix, you know, needs to be improved security-wise. And they said to us, yeah, we can do that. And but it'll be about $900,000 and it's gonna take about 6 months. Well, Gary, Jan, Michael, and Ivan here came to our group because we have a group that works on all these fare collection stuff. And Ivan, per se, said, you know, give me a chance at trying to fix this ourselves. And so the concept was, let's take a new product, and the one we used was called Authorize.net, that a lot of people are out there. It has high security functions and features. And let's see if we can create a way to bolt it on to the old WebTix. So our customers would go through all this high security, with their credit cards, and then they would ultimately buy the credit card through our processes. And Ivan here figured that out. He actually wrote the code that combined this brand new thing with this old web text. Jan Michael found authorize.net and worked with them to get that in, and Gary Dexter, kind of the leader of this group, was coordinating it all. We did that, and Ivan, within about 3 weeks, I think, developed that. We tested it, and it's up and running now, and it's reduced our chargebacks by about 90%. We're still getting a couple, but we're no longer in trouble with Bank America in terms of exceeding these chargebacks and getting fined, et cetera, et cetera. So at least for the time being, we're okay. But, you know, the criminals kind of get more savvy all the time. And then internally, Aaron here, who is our controller, has been working with all this backroom stuff, and we finally found a culprit on the internet who was selling our passes. We engaged San Diego PD. They put a detective on it, and Aaron has been working with him to try to build this case for, I don't know, 3 months or so. Yesterday, he was arrested. The police put forth 70 counts of fraud on him, plus five other counts that I'm not particularly sure. I think the DA charged him with 32 counts or 34 counts, plus some other things. I think the guy's going to jail for a long time. So I just wanted to recognize these people as a hugely extraordinary effort in a problem that we deal with all the time and saved us a bunch of money. So thank you.
Well, it's always a pleasure to know that we have, and time and again, recognized the quality of the folks that we have working for us, this organization. I know that my long association, I have nothing but pride in the fact that I'm fortunate enough to be a part of it. And I think whenever we can, we'll certainly recognize people for your benefit so that you have a sense of just what we're capable of doing. And it's very gratifying. And I'm certainly grateful to our employees who do such good work. And we've had countless examples of it. But this was a really great example of just the kind of talent we have inside to deal with some pretty challenging problems. Okay, we'll go on to the consent items, and that's item 6 through 14. And is there anyone who has a question or wants to pull any of the items for discussion? If not, I'll take a motion for approval from Cunningham and second by Minto. No further discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you very much. And now we'll go into a closed session, and we'll be right back. All right, we're back in open session, and our council report out.
On item number 24A, closed session conference with legal counsel in the Pacific Imperial Railroad bankruptcy case, the board received a report from legal counsel. In item number 24B, closed session public employee performance evaluation and conference with labor negotiators, the board conducted a performance evaluation and gave instructions to its labor negotiator.
All right, thank you very much. And we'll go on now to item 30. And we have a report here from Ron Rundle from Sandag. Welcome, Ron. And Sharon will introduce.
Sure. So last month we had a brief discussion about Measure A, and General Counsel gave you some legal advice regarding our ability to go for a ballot measure on transit-related issues. At that point, we were asked to return after the Sandag held their retreat to discuss the issue of ballot Measure A. And what we've asked is that Sandag's Rob Rundle, who was the transportation planner who presented at the Sandag retreat, give you the same presentation, and then we'd open it up for discussion. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Sharon. Thank you, members of the MTS board. Thanks for having me here today. So, yes, I wanted to just give a recap of what was presented to the Sandag Board of Directors at the board retreat last Friday. And as you know, Sandag adopted a regional transportation plan, the regional plan San Diego Forward, in October of 2015. And right after the Sandag Board adopted the regional plan, they moved right into developing an expenditure plan and ordinance to implement the expenditure plan for a funding measure that was on the November ballot known as Measure A. And this slide outlines those funding categories that were included in the measure. And without walking through each of these steps, you can see on line 4 and 4A, B, and C are the transit categories. About 42% of Measure A would have funded transit capital operations and specialized transportation grants. A lot of the transit capital included the Purple Line trolley, which would have which is planned to go from San Ysidro to Kearny Mesa, and then there were a lot of rapid bus projects and transit operations, and then again the specialized transit grants that provide those specialized services for senior disabled students and the military, as was outlined in the measure. This slide shows where those projects are located, the regional projects, where they're located geographically in the region, the red being the transit projects that were included in the measure. And again, all these projects are included in the regional transportation plan, so they're still part of the transportation vision. It's just a matter of when they will get built now that Measure A did not pass. And this is the language that was on the ballot for Measure A. And at the bottom is the election results with the yes votes 58%, no votes 42%. So you can see there was majority support for Measure A, but not enough to meet the two-thirds voters threshold requirement. Just looking a little more closely at the numbers, there's pretty high voter turnout in November with 81%, and of those people, 75% of the registered voters voted on Measure A. So you can see the total yes and no votes there. To have passed Measure A would have required that about 100,000, a little over 100,000 of those no votes would have had to vote yes in order to pass Measure A. So that's a pretty significant hurdle. On this map, I know you can't see it well, but this is the precincts in San Diego County, and this shows the voter results. So the darkest green color being those that where those precincts met the two-thirds threshold requirement. The two lighter color greens are over 50%, but not to the 66.7%. And then the yellow are those areas that voted with less than 50%. And so I'm just gonna show these numbers in a couple other maps, same information, after this. This is just by city or by jurisdiction, how the jurisdictions voted. So you can see there are three jurisdictions, Chula Vista, Imperial Beach, and National City that met the two-thirds voter threshold, and the rest of the jurisdictions did not. Some came very close, but was still far short of where it would have had to be to pass. So this shows the Sandag subregions, the North County Coastal, North County Inland, City of San Diego, unincorporated area, and South County, and how they voted, just looking at those subgroups. So can see there's more support for the measure in the urbanized areas of the region and primarily in the southern portion of the region. I'm also going to show by supervisorial district, so in the south again, and you can see those top three, or I should say the northern three districts, District 5, District 3, and District 2. It looks like there's a little variation, but if you look at the numbers, they're very close, right around the mid-50s. As far as the percentage, and then a little higher voter approval in the southern two districts. In the city of San Diego, being the largest jurisdiction in the region, I just wanted to show you the same information by council district. So again, kind of holds the same pattern where there's more voter support in the southern part of the city of San Diego, and then mid-support in the central portion, and then support falls off up in the north. And then the last map I want to show you just compares the Transnet measure in 2004 on the left with Measure A, which was on the November ballot on the right-hand side. And if you recall, in 2004, when the Transnet measure passed, it passed by, it met the two-thirds voter threshold, obviously, but it passed by a very thin margin. There's a few thousand votes over that 66.7%. But that map on the left is what that looks like to get that two-thirds voter approval. It shows pretty broad consensus throughout the region. And you can see on the right, in this past November, there was significantly less support for Measure A. And that was what the board at the retreat on Friday talked a lot about, different options moving forward. At the board retreat, they have a lot of discussion. They don't usually come to any conclusions because the board likes to make their decisions in the Sandegg boardroom back here where we are downtown, where they typically meet. So they had a robust discussion about the results, but with the where we are right now with updating the regional plan that I mentioned was adopted in November 2015, they're starting that process. So the funding issues and the projects are all going to be part of ongoing discussions that the board has moving forward. So that's my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Before we get into any general discussion, I do have a speaker, so let me bring the speaker up and then we'll get into the discussion. And Kathleen Ferrier, representing Circulate San Diego.
Hi, good morning. Kathleen Ferrier, representing Circulate San Diego. I wanted to come to speak today. There was a lot of discussion at the board retreat about a potential sub-regional measure, and we were hoping that there'd be some more of that today here with you. We support that kind of a measure, and we'd like to ask that MTS work with Sandegg to publish or develop a list of options for those kinds of measures moving forward, and specifically things that obviously you're legally capable of doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Yeah. Mayor Salas?
Yeah, I kind of wanted to more expansion on, well, actually, none of the information is here. You know, when we were developing the polling information, when we got all the polling information about what was supported by voters, whether you know, the highway projects were supported more than the transit or the active transportation or the open space. That would be interesting to see, you know, where the support lied for, say, public transit. But also, I think that the measure failed because there was just too much packed into it. And so would it make a difference? Would there be a difference in the polling if you had a transit only measure that was put forward by MTS and Sandegg that would just focus on the trolleys and on the buses? If it was isolated like that, what would be, I think there would be have to be polling as to what support would be for that. Was there anything like that done at all?
We did do polling along the way when the expenditure plan was being developed, and we tested certain projects like the Purple Trolley Line, which was one of the best performing projects in the measure. It did really well in the surveys that were conducted. A lot of the other projects, like in for instance in the North County, the 78 did well, because a lot of those, when the polling was done, those are done in sub-regional areas, so we're not asking the entire region how they feel about 78, but asking the voters in that area of the region. Same with the Purple Line and all those projects that were surveyed individually. You're testing it in those sub areas where those projects are. But to answer your question, some of the transit projects did perform really well, others did not. Some of the bus services did not perform as well. Some of the roadway projects were very popular with voters in those areas, but we didn't test just a transit only or a highway only. We tested this whole package.
I can tell you that I served on a sort of a quality of life committee that was advisory, and that was started probably in 2008. I mean, when they first started trying to meet the TransNet obligation to put a new ballot measure on, and they did test transit only. They tested, you know, all these different things, but I don't think anything else has since then been done by SANDAG.
Do you recall the results of a transit only?
I wouldn't want to tell. I know that it didn't reach the threshold of being successful on it as a standalone at that time.
But was it a transit only in the whole county of San Diego, or was it that a
it was
transit
in the whole
only?
County of San Diego.
Yeah, which might be different sub-regionally.
I think I remember talking to Gary. I don't know how long ago, and I think they did test it. And it didn't do well, but I think it was for the whole county, and I think that's surprise. That's not all that surprising, right? I mean, I think we all know now because of the data that we're seeing is that transit would pull much better in the southern portion of the county. You know, where this one did, you know, this one did better than any place else in the southern part of the county.
Well, I know as an elected official from the South region and representing a city that uses transit quite readily and also a city that has some major transit projects on the board now, is I would like to see if there's any interest from the board to pursuing something with SANDAG that would allow us to go on a sub-regional basis and looking at certain projects that were related to transit. And I don't know if any of the other board members have any interest in that.
Yeah, I would like to follow up on that. I think I would be very much interested in something like that. I would be very much interested. I don't know if you made reference to there have been some statements that have been made right now that there have been a regional polling around transit. Can we do a sub-regional transit-only poll to see how it looks like? It seems like South Bay, the urban core, San Diego is very. I would be interested just to see what people think around transit, and if we are thinking about doing a specific area type of initiative, maybe some of that information can help us move forward in deciding.
Anyone else? Yes, Mr. Alvarez.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that I think I'm interested. I've been asking for information on this for some time. My first question would be the transit, not the transit, the matrix, excuse me, on page 2, which where you mentioned the transit capital operations total. Does this include projects outside of MTS's jurisdiction?
Yes. Yes, okay. It includes the entire region, so it's also coaster projects and yeah.
Okay. And how much of it is MTS? That was one of the questions I had asked, not you, but here before.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't have that. I could get that for you, though.
Okay, that would be very helpful. Yeah. Appreciate that.
Transit was 42% of the whole measure. Do you remember what the split was?
Couldn't split it completely down because some of the categories were for both. And they weren't specific as to what was in those categories.
My guess, if I had to just answer your question, is that we were probably at least 2/3 of that would have been for us. I mean, I want to say 75% because usually that's the way we kind of split things between north and south based on a whole lot of factors, 75-25. But so it's probably between 2/3 and 3/4, I would think, of that 42%.
And in fact, I could mention that we brought it here to the board because North County Transit District specifically asked that all of the transit funding be split by that. And we had suggested that that's not the right way to plan for 40 years because who knows what the most important priorities would be.
So it may have been closer to 75% for MTS.
Yeah, we did some calculation, but as Sharon mentioned, some of the categories, it's not clear where the money would end up. So, you know, both service areas would be eligible, but we can get you a ballpark.
Excuse me, Mr. Alves, is your microphone on, or is it?
Sorry, it was, and it turned off. Can you also get information on the member cities to MTS and what a what the half cent measure would have brought in by city? Did you do those calculations? In the assumptions that were used of what the revenue stream was going to be?
For the local funding piece or just?
Yes, sorry, just for the revenue stream from the measure.
In the, are you talking about this local infrastructure that would have gone to each city for their piece?
No, I'm actually referring to just the transit.
Of a half cent, how much?
If I can clarify, I think what Councilmember Alvarez is asking for is he would like to see just our jurisdictional cities.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the unincorporated county as well. That's in our
if
area.
It's in, yeah.
Did you break out down how much sales tax revenue would come in based on this measure passing in each city?
I'm sure we can get that information. I don't know that
is
we've
it
done
that granular?
Calculation, but
okay.
Probably. I mean, it's.
I think that's a valuable piece of information.
Yes.
Yeah.
As we look on a sub-regional basis, need to understand what kind of revenue that's going to generate.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, and let me try to be clear about what I've been saying about the sub-regional, which I think people are looking at this differently. I don't think we should be looking at south versus north. I'm from my responsibility to this board is to look at MTS and its operations and its function. And so what I would be interested this body focusing on is the transit operations, the transit capital that was included in Measure A. What that cost is and what the revenue that could be generated from the member agencies, the member cities to this agency. And I think when we talk about regional, or at least what I heard some people making reference to regional at the SANDAG board, was things like local infrastructure for the local regions, which I said then and I still believe today that each of us are responsible for our own cities. And if we want to see more roads getting fixed, then we should be passing tax increases in our own city if that's what you want. Or if the county wants to do that, they should do that as well. But for this perspective of this board, our duty is on transit operations and the transit system. And so I'm interested in seeing it divided as that kind of a category. I wouldn't call it a region, sub-region. I would call it a category of Measure A. Am I being clear about what I'm seeing or what I'm suggesting?
Yeah. Just okay. To recap, I think you want to dissect Measure A, find out exactly of whatever that number was, all the projects and their costs
right.
That would have directly been attributable to MTS.
Right.
And then I think based on the other questions, we'd have to look at the MTS jurisdiction and get the tax revenue estimates by jurisdiction.
Right, right.
In our area.
Right.
At least those two pieces.
That's very important information for us to continue to have this discussion of whether this makes sense or not. Do you know what the projected shortfall of the 2004 Transnet, given the what appears to be incorrect calculation of the revenue, what impact that has on MTS and its programs?
I don't have that information, and our SANDAG board is going to be discussing that in a little more detail. So as soon as we have some additional information, we can definitely share that with you.
I think that's going to be important because I think it's probably going to show that we're going to fall short with the assumptions of 2004, which means if we expected to put stuff online utilizing revenue from that measure, that's going to be an important piece to anything that this board decides to do or not to do as it relates to a measure. And this is maybe for you, Karen, our counsel. Would an MTS only, which I read the minutes, and I apologize I couldn't be here at the last meeting, but I read the minutes and I didn't see any discussion of this. Would a measure that would be MTS focused or centered or led require a two-thirds vote? Did we do further analysis on that?
Yes, any sales tax has to be a two-thirds vote. So, I mean, that's the prop, the California Constitution, so.
Well, a general sales tax is not a two-thirds vote, though.
I will certainly check that, but my understanding of the research that I've done and the other tax measures, that it, just because it's MTS wouldn't change the percentage of vote required, but I will certainly confirm.
And I think your research included other transit agencies that did these types of taxes, is that?
Well, and I definitely, the research I did in time for the January meeting was very preliminary, so it was addressing first the question of do we currently have the right to do a sales tax measure? And so, you know, just outlining where does the approval for that, and that it would have to be in our statute, and we don't personally at MTS have that.
Right.
So I didn't do the next level of research of if we wanted to go forward and ask for one, how should we package it? What are all the pitfalls of each proposal? And what are the different requirements? I can say I was assuming it would be a two-thirds vote by the voters, but I will definitely go back and confirm that.
I'm almost sure, though, that LA was a two-thirds requirement.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And Sacramento lost theirs, and they were very close to the situation we were in. But I think the threshold was two-thirds in both those cases.
And I'm just curious if we could use other vehicles like an infrastructure financing district for the infrastructure component, the capital component of the measure, which that threshold has been reduced by the legislature to 55. And that could be a different, I don't know, maybe not. Like,
I would have to do more research. I don't, like, I looked like preliminary at some of, again, that would be something that would need to be in our board section, but I can certainly do that. We decided to, at the last meeting, to defer kind of next steps. How do we want to handle this? What do we want us to look into until after the SANDAG board retreat and this data on what the polling was? So kind of now is the time for me to get the list of what are the areas that you want me to do research on, and how do we want to bring that back to the board?
Well, I also thought that legislation, too, was sunsetting very quickly.
That's, I think, a separate. There is some legislation about and infrastructure for transit only that's sunsetting, but I think you might be referring to something different. So I'll go out and...
There's been a couple of new mechanisms created by the legislature to allow for this. My last point would be that I would request that... I was at part of the SANDAG board, not all of it, and I don't know that they reached finality as to what they want to do next. As a member of this body, I would like to request that we further pursue this as an alternative by doing the research that we just talked about, both fiscally and also legal research that Karen can do, and bring the item back again next month to continue the conversation on this.
Councilmember Alvarez, I would also suggest, as we look at that legal, while the one thing would be to MTS to seek legislation to amend our enabling legislation to allow us to go out for a sales tax in our region, that we probably also should figure out whether we could go sub-regional within our jurisdiction. And I know we don't have the answer to that question.
I would agree with that.
But I think we should look at that in order to provide a bigger picture or a more complete picture.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, and very important is, I had a discussion with Gary Gallegos as well, as you know, getting the information is, if you were going to go through an MTS agency only transit measure, what would the polling be within that full jurisdiction? Because I think that will help us make a decision of whether we go sub-regionally within that jurisdiction as well.
Mr. Roberts.
The mayor just actually raised something that I thought would be critical to add to the information. I don't think we have a breakdown of how this performed in MTS. And that may be surprising. We had great support. I mean, if we were going to do a sub-regional, I'd say put Chula Vista and National City together and do it there and forget everybody else, but you know, I don't know where you're going to run your public transit to, but I think there's a strong interest throughout the county, as strong as our interest maybe is in public transit, and I'm sure this comes as a shock to many of you. There are other parts of the county that have an equally strong interest in roads and how they can get there. The irony is that whether almost every jurisdiction in the county needs money for their own roads right now, that this would have, Measure A would have provided in a significant degree, and everybody's scrambling, and some of the outstanding opponents of Measure A are the ones that are now realizing they've got major shortfalls on their roads. And I'll tell you, I know one county supervisor who's all of a sudden realized that, who basically didn't support Measure A and is realizing that, gee, we could have used that money for roads. And there's a couple of mayors around that they'll tell you are also in that category. I won't get too specific, but they know who they are.
Well, I think that Mr. Alvarez said it right at the Sandag retreat, is that, you know, as leaders of our community, we know what our budgets are. We know that there's a finite amount of money, and no matter how much we wish we could do everything, you can't do it with the money at hand. And so, you know, Chula Vista did pass a sales tax measure, and we're going to be able to do a lot with that. But I know other cities that have taken that road, like National City, and I think it was La Mesa and El Cajon. I'm not sure if it was El Cajon, but you know, it's a tough thing to try to show to your voters that you're going to be responsible with the money that's entrusted to them. But the improvements that have been, you know, that have occurred in those cities are as a result of that money being earmarked for those specific projects. So that's our job to do as leaders in the community as well.
Okay. Anybody else have anything? If not, I think we'll follow up on the suggestions made. And Rob, maybe you can generate some information that you've been asked for. And we'll bring it back to you for further discussion. Okay, moving on. Thanks very much. This is an information item, and I think direction has been given, so we'll take it from there. Okay, I'm going to go out of.
No, it's just 31.
Okay, yeah, you're right. Okay, the security services. I saw Mike there. Security services agreement. This is an important one. We need to take care of this one in the time we have left. So. Who's going to lead off? Manny, you're going to lead off, or is Mike? Yeah, okay, go ahead, Mike.
Just a quick recap of the political timeline. It seems like this has been out in the environment forever, but it was finally passed by the San Diego measure in June of 2016 to increase the minimum wage in the city of San Diego, and the state legislation increased the minimum wage in April of last year. Both of those things impacted this security contract. So the security contract was originally passed by this board in February of last year. And because of all the talk about minimum wage changes, in that contract there included included language that said if there's any changes to the minimum wage legislation, we would reopen the negotiations and not hold them to the numbers they put forward that didn't include impacts to minimum wages at that point in time. Now, that security contract had been going on for quite some time, and the contract actually expired in June 30th, so we had to get that finalized before the legislation was all finished. And then once legislation was finished, we could revisit it, and that's what we did. The legislation is in two pieces. Both the state and the city have their own minimum wage requirements. The rate that's in effect is the one that's most favorable to the employees. So for the first few years, if the city of San Diego rate is what is applicable. And then as you get to 1/1/2019, the state rate is more favorable to the employee. So that is what becomes applicable at that point in time. So those are the rates that are bolded on this slide three. Those are the rates that the contract must comply with. So that is what we took back to UPS. And, well, let's recap real quick, the original contract. So the original contract includes a number of different employee categories. It ranges from the temporary special event employees to uniformed unarmed officers and uniformed officers, and then the supervision above that. A majority of the contract, the original contract, is in the uniformed officers, both armed and unarmed. It is 168 of the 194 FTEs. It's $30 million of the $39 million original contract. So that's where all the dollars are. And in the contract, in both this contract that was approved last February and the contract prior to that with UPS and MTS, there are progression steps of how an employee that rewards employees for longevity with the organization. And I want to highlight that on this next slide, just walking through one particular example. And this is for unarmed officers, this table here below in the original contract. But there are similar progressions for both armed officers and armed sergeants. So what you can see is if an employee started on July 1st of 2016, that would be in year one, they'd be making $10.50 right off the bat. Then every 6 months, there's progressions where their wage increases based on how long they stay. So if they stayed for the entire 5 years of the contract, at the end of the period, they'd be making $11.40 in year five as they stepped each 6 months up to a new wage rate. So this is a progression tiers. It's the basis of the entire contract, and this is the original rates. And again, there are similar progressions for both armed officers and armed sergeants. So when the new laws were passed, let me stand here real quick, you can see a lot of these wages are underneath the new minimum wage requirements. In year four, it gets up to $12. Not one rate on there is above $12. In year five, it's even higher. So that's why we're going back to the drawing board with UPS to revisit the contract rates. So after the passage of the city measure, we began negotiations with UPS. UPS's approach in this contract renegotiations was to bring it into compliance with the minimum wage laws, obviously, but they also would like to keep the differentiation between the employees in place, where they have the temporary non-uniformed, then the uniformed, then the armed uniform. They need those differentiators to be able to manage their business. They also wanted to preserve the growth in wages based on years of service and experience to reward the employees that were staying. So what they put forth is a revised proposal, taking into account the minimum wages. It keeps the progression, keeps the separation between unarmed and armed and the temporary employees, and that also keeps the progression for the experience. So this is an example again of the unarmed in their July proposal based on the new minimum wage. And we put the minimum wage on this chart, how it changes from these periods. That's the first line going from $10.50 to $14 over that contract period. And then the unarmed officers was making 50 cents more than minimum wage in those periods. And then the progression down each step, you know, was kept the same from there. So using the same example, someone hired on July 1 of 2016, they would progress over the course of the contract in this proposal to $15.45 by January 2021 at the last year of the contract. So it kept that reward for people staying, which UPS feels is important to keep their retention numbers, and it also complied with minimum wages. Now, by doing it this way, it did create a lot of cost increase. This contract increase would have totaled almost $45 million. It's almost a $6 million increase from the original contract. So this is what was brought to the board in July, and then also reviewed in more detail with the BDC in October. And the direction to staff was to revisit how this was done and look for more cost-effective options, and then try to be more aggressive in controlling costs, yet still complying with the minimum wage laws. And a couple of things that resulted out of that is the need to eliminate that year-by-year progression structure every 6 months or so with the wages increasing, and then let minimum wage be the driver of the wage increases over the course of the contract. And then also to keep anyone that was already above that minimum wage rate, don't automatically bump them because of minimum wage, but keep that more static. So staff entered in negotiations with UPS again back in October, and that continued for a few months. The major concerns on the UPS side was keeping that differentiation between special event, the temporary employees, and the unarmed and armed. And then They were willing to modify the progression structure to more simpler flat structure based on minimum wage, and then they still are very concerned with retention and their ability to hire and train and their own union negotiations on their side. So the results of the negotiations was a new contract that we bring forward to you today with this value is $43.9 million, so it's still almost $5 million above the original $39 million contract, but it is $1.1 million below what was brought to the board in July. It does keep the temporary special event assistance at minimum wage. It keeps unarmed officers 50 cents above that, and then armed officers would be $1.50 above minimum wage or $1 above the unarmed. So when you look at the overall results, again, it's $43.9 million. The majority of it is still in unarmed and unarmed officers. That's 34 million of the 44. The important thing to note is that progression table that I just showed you, it used to be 11 steps for unarmed officers. By the end of this contract period, that'll be gone. They'll all be making that one rate. There'll be no steps above that for longevity. Same with armed officers. By the end of that contract period, there will be no progressions for them anymore. It'll just be whatever that, they'll have one rate for that period of time. And as minimum wage increases, they'll get wage increases. So this was presented to the Budget Development Committee in January. And again, contract total $43.9 million. It is compliant with minimum wage law. It does eliminate progression tiers within that five-year contract period. And it also does assume the same 194 FTEs as the original contract. Now, as this process was all going on, the security staff was also looking at their overall operations and looking for the way they deploy all resources, both internal and external, and seeing if there's more efficient ways to doing that. And with that, I'll turn it over to Manny.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, everyone. Chairman Mathis. Since the time I was hired as deputy director and then later when I became the chief, I continually looked at ways where we can improve efficiency and visibility on our system. And I brainstormed this frequently with my staff. I brought different ideas to Paul, got some feedback from him, and we came up with a plan that not only improves our efficiency and our enforcement capability, but it also saves us money. So we currently have 194 contracted security officers, and I put allocated there because that's what's allocated, but the contractors had difficulty reaching those numbers. So oftentimes when they're short, they have to hire someone on overtime at their cost to fill those spots. The security officers have private person's arrest, which means they can make a citizen's arrest just like anybody else here can make, but they do have a visible presence. And then we have 34 co-compliance inspectors, and they're public officers with the powers of arrest. And so they have limited authorities on our property and on our systems. So our staffing proposal, we did some analysis, and starting off with our HR department and later by our finance department, that if we reduced 50 contracted security officers, we could hire 30 co-compliance inspectors. Which would be MTS employees. And so currently all of our staff either works Wednesday through Saturday or Sunday through Wednesday. So we have a barrel day, which everybody works on that day. And so part of the staffing plan is to reduce or to eliminate the barrel day for co-compliance inspectors. And we can actually increase the uniform presence during our day watch and essentially maintain the uniform presence during a night watch, but it triples our enforcement capability. And so this is where we, I mentioned we had 34 co-compliance inspectors, but when you remove the supervisors and the our canine officers, we actually have 21 co-compliance inspectors that are actually out in the field conducting enforcement. So adding 30 would be a huge addition to that team. And the way the portions that we're gonna cut out of the contract was 27 unarmed officers, 20 armed officers, and we cut more of the unarmed officers because we need a minimum of 65 really to implement the deployment plan that I'm going to go into in just a few minutes, and it reduces three supervisors from the UPS side, our contractor. And this is our day watch staffing, if you look at currently, this is our staffing, minimum staffing every day on day watch. We have 5 co-compliance inspectors, 34 UPS security officers, and so we have 39 uniform personnel working during the day watch. And you can see on Wednesdays that doubles. It's important that we have that barrel day now because we use that barrel day when we have the additional resources to conduct special enforcement details. And if we have a special event, that barrel day doesn't always land on a Wednesday. UPS can move those personnel if we need to work a Charger game or any other event that impacts us. And the way our operations work, and co-compliance inspector is teamed up with an armed security officer. So when there's 5 MTS CCIs out there, that's also their partner with a security officer. So with our proposal on day watch, it actually, we have 14 co-compliance inspectors paired with the security officer every day of the week except for Sunday. And we actually have more uniform presence during day watch than we currently do now. And if you look at nighttime, same amount of co-compliance inspectors working at night. That's 5 co-compliance inspectors covering all 3 lines, all 53 miles of our lines. And you can see with this proposal, it increases average 15 to 17, and one day on Sunday, we only have 13. But we pretty much stay close to the same number of uniform presence at night. However, again, our enforcement authority triples. Now, for this to work, we've come up with a deployment plan. We've created service area sectors, so instead of just having 3 lines, we've created 4 geographical areas, which I'll show you in just a moment. We've also broken that down even further into small beats, similar to police beats, but these are very small since they're on the trolley lines. And we did reduce some of our fixed post positions, but we did maintain fixed post positions or assignments at some of our busiest transit centers. Now, this is a map you've all seen of our lines. And if you see a number next to one of the stations, that's where we have currently have a fixed post position during day watch. And it's essentially the same at night, with the exception of an extra person at 5th Avenue and an extra person at 47th Street during the evenings. So these are the fixed post positions we currently have. These are staffed by security officers that do not have enforcement authority. So if they come up and have an issue, they either request a co-compliance inspector, or if it's of a more serious nature, then they request the police. And this is how the new service area sector would look. We didn't divide it 100% by lines because there are overlaps in the system. So we have a north sector, which is predominantly green line and a little bit of orange. We have the east sector, which is predominantly orange line, the metro, which incorporates all 3 lines, and then we have the south line. And if you look at the beats, and these are not set in stone, we think these are the optimal places to create the beats, but it's subject to change based on activity levels. But if you look at just the easy one to look at is the Chula Vista stations, E, H, and Palomar. So instead of a security officer being fixed at one place, they will be getting on and off the trolley with their partner, co-compliance inspector, and a security officer will actually be responsible for those 3 stations. So we would expect them to board at one station, conduct their checks on this train. If there's no activity on there, step off at the next station, get back on a different car. So it really increases the visibility of a uniform presence. Plus, we have a much better capability of enforcing any code of conduct or ordinances or any other laws that we are allowed to enforce. So in the metro area, we didn't draw it out because it's such a small area. We actually created 4 beats there because right now we have 2 security officers at 12th and Imperial, and we would replace one of those with a co-compliance inspector that would be there permanently, so it actually can conduct enforcement there during all revenue hours. And we haven't quite decided how to break down the areas in Metro. So So the benefits of this is an increased uniform presence and visibility on board our trolleys and our transit stations, and there's an improved perception of security because they will definitely be seen more than you see uniformed personnel now. There'll be an increased enforcement of MTS ordinances and transit-related laws, which will impact our fare evasion rate. Quite often now, when a security officer comes across someone without a fare, if we can't get a code compliance inspector there in a timely manner, then they end up, that person ends up getting a warning. And we can have chronic people that get warnings on a regular basis. We're going to have better trained, career-minded employees with improved professionalism. Right now, UPS has an 80% turnover rate of their employees, and we have a very low turnover rate of our code compliance inspectors. It eliminates the need for the Eagle team. We have an Eagle team that starts at 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and we have one security officer riding the trains on each line. Because we'll have enough trained teams with a code compliance inspector, we'll actually have two people on each train at night. And so it eliminates the overtime that we use to staff that. And that's about $100,000 a year. I mentioned it improves our personnel retention, and we project to save over $1 million over the next 4 years. So this is not a compromise. This is a plan to improve our capabilities, efficiency, and our visibility in the system. And here's a breakdown of cost. If you just looked at FY18, the cost for us that first year is $1.7 million in personnel costs. We'll save $100,000 in overtime on the Eagle team. There is a startup cost of about $210,000, and that's for equipment, uniforms. There'll be a little bit of an overlap when we transition from the reduction of security officers and add the co-compliance inspectors. And so even that first year, we still save $72,000, and then over the next 4 years, over $1 million. This would also reduce the contract to UPS to $35.9 million. And we've already had that discussion with them.
Is that yours? So this is sort of a recap. So the original contract that was approved by the board last February was for $39 million. The impact of negotiations to the minimum wage was an increase of $4.8 million, bringing you to almost $44 million. And then based on this reallocation of staffing plan, we would reduce the contract amount by another $7.9 million. So the contract being proposed to you today is for $35.9 million for UPS. Now, there is additional budget impact on the opposite side for staffing, which is almost $7 million. So the total budget impact, taking all that into consideration, so $4.8 million due to minimum wages. The next savings from this shifting from UPS to MTS is a savings of $1 million. So it's a $3.8 million increase overall. For MTS over this five-year period. And that brings us to the staff recommendation. The staff recommendations that the Board of Directors receive a report on the updated negotiations with UPS and a reallocation of UPS contract officers to internal compliance officers. So approve the increased contract spend to the UPS security service contract as summarized in attachment A as a result of the latest minimum wage modifications and negotiations with UPS. And then approve reducing a total of 50 full-time equivalent UPS contract officers, which is 27 unarmed, 20 armed, and 3 armed sergeants, with from the existing UPS contract and increasing internal code compliance officers by 30 FTEs. So that concludes our presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
And I should also add that we put this proposal in terms between the Security Committee as well as the Budget Development Committee, I think, not the EC, right? Budget Development.
Mr. Alvarez.
Thank you. Great presentation. Thank you for a lot of the stuff that you brought up was not the intent of when we first talked about it, but I think it's served a really good purpose, at least from the public safety standpoint. I think you've thought it through quite extensively on how this could work better as a system. I'm a little bit confused about the cost numbers, not the rest of the plan. I think I understand that quite well. And again, I think it's a good direction to go in. Can you go back one more slide and the summary, yeah. So when we first discussed this, we were all discussing the UPS contract and the minimum wage, and we wanted to see you reworked that, which you've done. It's reduced. So on the UPS contract, it's been reduced by $4 million, actually less than that, about $3 million. And then there are impacts to our internal budget because of the change with the code compliance officers, which is part of the whole plan, but it's a minimum wage impact, not the 30 FTE impact?
The 30 FTE impact is in this $1 million line, right?
So okay.
Maybe I can help.
So if you look on this chart that you're looking at right now, you have everything except one number, and that number is on the previous slide, which the internal costs are 6.886725. So that's what we're adding to our budget. It's kind of the middle of the page, way on the right hand side, total internal costs. So we're going to add 6.8 million to our budget to hire the new code compliance officers, and we're going to reduce the UPS contract by 50 officers, and that's going to save us 7.9 million. So the net result just on personnel is $1 million savings, but then we have an increase due to minimum wage on all the officers remanded, right?
Right, I think this slide on 23.
So the total budget impact is 3.7 million.
And yeah, no, I get the total budget impact. I just, I'm trying to understand where the 30 FTEs, which line do the 30 FTEs go in?
It's in this $1 million savings. So if you, it does tie better, as Paul said. The $1 million is right here. That's plus 30 FTEs and minus 50 FTEs, and that's to the $1 million savings.
Okay.
So if we would list it that way, and this line, you'd have $4.8 million from minimum wage. You'd have plus $6.8 million of 30 FTEs, minus $7.9 million of less those 50 FTEs, and then you would be an increase of $3.7 million. And that's basically getting from the original 39 to about a $42 million number. And the $42 million number is 35 for UPS and 7 for MTS, basically.
Yeah. So that explanation actually is, you know, easier to grasp for some of us who sometimes can't grasp up on this board. So we're reducing UPS officers, increasing the code compliance officers, providing a better service. So it's less people, but it's providing a more coordinated, better service, I'll just call it that, from a public safety standpoint. And the total additional cost of providing the extra, not the extra, the new coordinated service is about $3 million.
No, it's actually a reduction of $1 million.
No.
There's two things. We're talking about a personnel change.
Okay, we're talking about a personnel change in one, and we're talking about compliance with minimum wage on the other side. And they're both working together, and that's what's causing the confusion.
Right, and when we first discussed this, it was only UPS.
That's right. So we're only dealing with that.
Yeah.
You then asked us to go back to the drawing board, right?
Right.
So we went back to the drawing board, and we negotiated with UPS on a less costly proposal. But then at the same time, we started to look, say, what else could we do? Okay? What else could we do to, you know, hopefully win-win. It was originally to save costs that we could provide the Budget Development Committee with some options, but then in working with this idea that Manny and his staff had was that we could actually get better coverage, and those numbers are kind of counterintuitive, but it's this barrel day having everybody work on Wednesdays that provided a lot of opportunity for us to dismantle that and spread the people out.
Right. So no, and like I said, I think this seems, and obviously you'll evaluate it as this goes forward, a better way to manage public safety. You're professionalizing a little more. I mean, the code officers, you know, are more stable, I assume, whereas the UPS, they come and go quite frequently. So I get it. It was just that it was when it first was presented to us, it was only UPS, and now it's incorporated a different. Yeah. I would, do you need a motion? Staff, yes. Recommendation? I'd move staff recommendation on this item. And again, thank you for the comprehensive overview of this.
Second by McClellan. So that's the staff recommendation. Is that correct, Mr. Alvarez? Yes, thank you. Any further? Yes, Ms.
Yes. Gomez. Sorry. That's okay. I'm new. No worries. Yeah, I just have a couple of questions. In relation to the UPS contract, is there an overtime cost associated to that contract? Is it already included in the contract?
There is an overtime assumption in the contract, and it's already included in those
overall totals. So it wouldn't be an extra cost later on.
It is what it is. So we'll pay whatever overtime is. But if it's above what the contracted cost, we'd come back to the board to get more spending authority. But there is an assumption built into the contract totals right now.
Although I want you to know that if UPS can't fulfill all their positions, and they pay overtime to fill those positions, that's on them.
Yeah.
Not us.
Yeah, I figure. Okay. Yeah, it shouldn't be on us if it is. Related to the internal code compliance, what's the base pay?
I know it's somewhere in the mid $16 range to start, okay. And there's progressive steps as they progress through their career.
Okay. Thank you. Uh-huh. That's all.
Anything else on this? If not, all in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Thank you very much. Thank you, Chief. Mike, stay there and make your report, and you got 1 minute.
Almost the same report as last one. For everyone that was here, we're unfavorable in passenger revenue.
It's almost the same report as last month. We're unfavorable in passenger revenue for the first 6 months. It's causing a negative variance of $3.4 million. We are currently offset, it's all driven by passenger levels. We are currently offsetting that with favorable experience and expenses of $3.6 million. That's largely in personnel. We're running favorable on somewhat in wages, but more in the fringe on the pension and the health and welfare sides. But again, in total, $3.6 million. So we're balancing for the first 6 months on the operating side. And this doesn't take into account subsidy revenue, which has been trending very unfavorably. We are going to the budget development committee next week with a mid-year budget amendment proposal. We do feel we'll be able to balance this year. We do have $2 million carryover from FY16, if you recall. That's gonna help us bridge these gaps, but we do have revenue issues. We're hoping expenses can make up the most of it, and we hope to actually have a balanced budget for this year. But again, we are using $2 million of carryover.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, we'll move on. We'll take, that was number 47, and we'll take 46 next with Brian Lane.
Yeah, this is a passenger survey that is conducted by SANAG on behalf of the two transit operators. The last time this was done was 2009. SANAG is responsible for doing this on our behalf. Brian's going to give you a quick rundown of some of the statistics in it, but as I mentioned in your board agenda, there is a link to the full survey if you're interested in really getting into deep dives on the data.
Good morning. My name is Brian Lane. I'm a senior transit planner with SANDAG. Darlan Molmat was the project manager for the study.
Excuse me a minute.
Sharon, you mentioned the link. Is that the one with SANDAG?
Yes, it is.
Because I went to it and it was no longer available.
Okay.
So
we'll
you can check
with
that.
Their IT.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead, Brian.
Sorry. She was the project manager for the study but cannot make it here today to present. I'll be happy to answer questions at the end, but also give you her contact information for more in-depth follow-up if you need it. As you know, SANDAG conducts a survey every 5 years of transit passengers on all fixed route and rail bus through routes throughout the San Diego region. The purpose of the survey is to collect statistically valid data to meet Title VI requirements for analysis of potential impacts of fare and service changes. SANDAG also uses the data to calibrate and validate our activity-based travel demand forecasting model. The most recent survey was conducted in 2015, and many of the questions are the same as prior years for comparison purposes. SANDAG is budgeting funds for next year to conduct a telephone survey to understand both riders and non-riders' opinions of transit in the region. The results of that should be available in 2019. I think you would also be interested in those results. For the survey, new methodologies were used to improve data quality as recommended by the FTA. The survey was administered primarily through face-to-face interviews using tablet PCs. Nearly 33,000 surveys were conducted throughout the region in English and Spanish. 29,000 of those were on MTS routes. Reports outlining the results are available on our website for the entire region as well as separately for each service type. We did one separately for MTS bus and MTS rail. We're in the process of putting together a SANDAG info publication presenting the region-wide results and anticipate releasing it later this month. So again, data uses mostly for Title VI, social equity analysis if there's ever a fare or a service change, travel forecasting for our activity-based modeling, and general transit planning and marketing efforts. Today I'll share the demographic profile of MTS passengers compared to the general population for the MTS service area, as well as breakouts for the bus and trolley. And then as needs arise, we're happy to provide additional analysis for specific routes. With respect to the demographic profile, I'll share data regarding age, ethnicity, income, and vehicle availability. As you can see in this slide, the majority, 54% of MTS transit passengers are under 30 years of age, with the largest proportion, 20 to 29. This age group and those 30 to 39 years of age are overrepresented among transit passengers compared to the general population in the area served by MTS. With respect to race and ethnicity, Hispanic represents the largest proportion, 42% of the MTS ridership relative to other ethnic groups, followed by whites. Compared to the general population in the MTS service area, Hispanics, blacks, and multiracial groups are overrepresented among MTS transit passengers, as shown by the red bars on this chart. Across MTS services, trolley passengers are more likely to be Hispanic, while a higher proportion of bus passengers are white, 30% compared to 24% of trolley riders. The total population in the MTS service area is also shown on this slide for reference. Income levels for MTS passengers are lower than the general population in the MTS service area. Almost half, or 45% of passenger households, have incomes under $30,000 compared to less than one quarter, or 23% of all households in the area served by MTS. Furthermore, 20% of transit passengers have incomes under $15,000. This proportion is 10% for the MTS service area population. The income distribution is very similar for both MTS bus and trolley passengers, consistent with the overall distribution on that previous slide. To assist with social equity analyses, low income and minority status is combined into a single measure. The first step is calculating poverty level based on household size and income. The 200% poverty level is used due to the higher cost of living in San Diego relative to the rest of the nation. Almost two-thirds, or 67% of MTS passengers, are below poverty. When this information is combined with answers to the ethnicity question, 87% are minorities and or have low incomes. The availability of a vehicle can impact transit use. Overall, about two-thirds, or 68% of MTS passengers, live in households with at least one car, as shown by the red line on the left. Of this group, 31% had a car available to use instead of transit, indicated by the red line on the right. Car ownership is similar for bus and trolley ridership. However, bus passengers are less likely to have a car available to use instead of riding the bus. That is, 28% of bus passengers could have driven a car, and this proportion was 36% for trolley riders. Based on region-wide data, not just the MTS data, but region-wide combined, comparisons between 2015 and the prior study in 2009 reveal a few key demographic changes. Proportion of young passengers is higher, with 62% 34 years of age or younger, compared to 56% in 2009. The lowest income category is down. In 2009, 30% of passengers had household incomes below $15,000, compared to 21% in the most recent survey. And riders with limited proficiency in the English language is up slightly from 9% in 2009 to 13% in 2015. To collect information about how about travel behavior, the survey asked passengers where they are coming from and going to, and how they are getting to transit from their origin, and how they are traveling from the transit stations to their final destination. They were also asked where they boarded and alighted, and maps are made for each of these routes displaying this information. This example is for the trolley's blue line to help assess how well the route serves the community, and kind of shows how far some passengers have to come to just to get to that line to then transfer. Specifically, I'll share data regarding trip purpose, mode for accessing transit, frequency of transit ridership, type of fare used, and satisfaction with transit services. At the top left, as the top left graph shows, commuter trips dominate MTS transit ridership overall, with 34% of passengers going between home and work, and another 33% between home and other places, which include shopping, medical appointments, family and friend visits. As you know, another thing that planners and maulers want to know is how passengers get to transit as well as their final destination. The most frequent method is walking. The pie charts on the left are for all MTS transit trips, and then the data on the right focuses solely on trips accessing transit from home and leaving transit to go home to help better assess the true volume of walking to and from transit. However, there is some variation across service types, with trolley passengers more likely to use a car to access transit. The data on this slide are for access to transit from home, and the patterns are similar for going home from transit. The majority of MTS passengers, 62%, use transit at least 4 days a week, with 17% riding 1 to 3 days, and a surprisingly large amount, 16%, riding each day. Half of all MTS passengers use a monthly pass, with about one quarter buying a day pass, and 10% using a one-way fare. Other fares include free children, employees, jury, and peace officers. While monthly passes are the type of fare used by the largest proportion of MTS bus and trolley passengers, trolley riders use day passes and one-way fares more often than those on the bus. While service satisfaction was not the focus of this survey, you guys do your own major service satisfaction surveys, one question did ask respondents to rate public transit service in their areas either good, fair, or poor. And overall, 70% of passengers are satisfied with the service overall, and specifically for bus and trolley passengers as well. Based on region-wide data, again, comparisons between 2015 and the prior study in 2009 reveal the following changes among transit passengers. Travel between home and work remains the most frequent trip purpose, up slightly from 31% in 2009 to 34% in 2015. The proportion riding 4 to 6 days a week is up from 56% to 62%. Monthly passes continue to be the most frequent fare used. Daily passes are up 6% in 2009 to 12% in 2015. And passengers rating transit service as good is up from 60% to 70%. All right, so to sum up, the data shows that more young, lower income, and minority passengers ride MTS than are represented in the overall service area, with 69% being transit dependent. MTS passengers primarily travel between home and work at least 4 days a week. Our contact information is included on the slide to facilitate any additional analysis that would be helpful for your planning and marketing efforts, and I'm happy to answer questions now.
Ms. Gomez.
Yes, this is great. Thank you so much, and it seems like the numbers have improved from previous years to this year, so it speaks to the systems that we have. Are there any areas that were highlighted of perhaps areas of improvement?
Not necessarily. This is more just laying out the data for you guys to look at. I don't know if Sharon and her staff have had much time to really digest all of this to kind of to dig into that.
Yeah, this is the raw data right now. It's in draft form. It hasn't been presented to SANDAG, and that's why we wanted to get it here prior to them taking it to the SANDAG board. What we use the data for generally is to see what kind of trends there are. They did do a different methodology this time and for surveying, so it's not going to be necessarily apples to oranges 2009 to 2015, but there are certain things that we can track a little bit. You'll notice that, for instance, there's more people using transit to get to work, and they're traveling more often. That would indicate probably they've got more employment and more income that they can use and go places with. So that is probably more in tune with the recession ending than it is with any kind of things that have happened on our system in the meantime. But those are the kinds of data points we'll be analyzing as we move forward.
Okay, thank you. We have one more report to give. If you, I'm sorry, did you want to go ahead, Ms. F?
Just a quick, I mean, you say that this information is for us, but it's good information, but what do we do with it? What are you going to do with it?
We use it for a lot of things. We use it for Title VI analysis when we do service changes or if we're considering improvements, placing infrastructure in the field, things like that. We use it for when we do things like our transit optimization plan, which we're doing right now.
Right.
We use it to track, for instance, are we getting beat on fares? You know, are we seeing a huge increase in certain aspects of our ridership? You know, are we getting more youth? Are we perhaps not getting more youth, which, you know, would indicate maybe there's something going on there, you know? So we really just will use it more on a, you know, what's happening in this trend, ridership trend and that kind of thing. So
two things stood out to me is that most passengers walk to and from transit, which shows clearly we need transit-oriented development, walking distance. I mean, it is off the charts. Everybody walks. So whether it's the trolley or the bus. So that's number one. And I think that that is a key thing that stands out. The other one that stands out is when you, the age group of people using transit, and when you get to especially to 60, it just drops off a cliff. So that's another clear indication that trying to get seniors on transit is, you know, it's a folly. They're just not for so many reasons, and that's why we need point-to-point transportation and the paratransit and so forth. So, you know, like I said, to me, those were the two major things that stood out, 20 to 29-year-olds using transit the most, and those are the ones most able to probably walk to and from and going to work. Those are the ones taking it to and from work. So, you know, some interesting information that was gleaned out of there. Thanks.
Okay, we have one more report to go, but it may take between 5 and 10 minutes.
I think we've lost
so many
people.
If anybody can stay, we can finish up. Otherwise, I'll ask Dennis.
Well, can you, I mean, there's so many, this is a really good report.
Let's hold it on.
Can we bring it back?
Yeah, okay, we'll bring it back next time.
I think you've given it short shrift at this point. You're losing, dropping like flies here, I'm seeing.
Yeah. But I do want to thank you all for staying on. I realize we're running over time, so thank you very much. We'll go quickly through the final things. I don't have anything to report. Mr. Jablonski, do you?
Just my travel. I went to the Sandag Board Retreat February 8th and 9th. APTA had the APTA CEOs Conference here in San Diego on the 11th and 13th, which I attended. And I went to Washington day before yesterday and yesterday to visit with our congressional delegation.
Any board member comments? Okay, I don't have any further public comments. So our next meeting date is March 9th, and we're adjourned. And thank you for staying.